Well, hey, everybody, welcome. This is our final seminar, and remember, we're going to hang out, those of you who are interested and have time after the top of the hour, just to have a discussion and cover anything that you'd like to talk further about or maybe wasn't covered or didn't quite make sense at the time. I look forward to that. But first, any additional comments, questions, things to clarify as we look at our final seminar, which is going to be on extreme success. And I'll explain in just a minute why I'm particularly emphasizing that. But thoughts or questions, or anything anybody wants to comment about? Well, the reason that I'm including this is that I think this is something that I don't see much discussed, not much research, about how to handle extreme success, the kinds of things that are beyond what was imagined, and especially the two challenges of sustaining extreme success after having arrived at all that you could possibly hope for, and dealing with the accompaniments of extreme success, like fame, like money, various things that I think you will increasingly see this challenge by your clients as you work with them, as they get more successful, as they exceed a model that they may have or any experience that they've ever had about dealing with extreme success. So it's something I want to talk about and have you think about with me and look toward and develop some ideas about, so that when your clients get there, you'll be ready. You'll be there hopefully a step before them. And remember, the guy who started this whole deal, professional coaching, Thomas Leonard, said, well, after all, you know, we just have to be one step ahead of our clients. And sometimes a half step is the best we can hope for. Any comments or questions or things you'd like to talk about as we move into our final seminar?
Yeah, Dave, it's Eric Jack here.
Hey, Eric. Go ahead.
How are you? Since I'm all warmed up, I'm doing great. Since I'm all warmed up on the topic.
Yeah.
And it's nice to talk to you a second time today. Might a good way to get into this particular topic, might it not be a bad idea in mentor coaching to actually try and define with the client what extreme success looks like to them?
And are you thinking about that after they look at what major success would be first, and then looking at it like a stretch goal, for example? Is that what you have in mind?
More of before they achieve it and then after they get it, to try and create a systematic process as they achieve it to help them deal with it. Does that make sense?
I think it does, and one practical way of doing that, because someone may be having difficulty imagining really what success is, so beyond that would be sort of incomprehensible, but a practical way maybe of doing that is to look at specific goals and look at how to attain them, the SMART goals and all that. And then what's a stretch goal? Sort of beyond your wildest imagination. And somebody can usually get what a stretch goal is. A few years ago, a stretch goal for me would be spending the month of March in steamboat skiing and the month of August on the coast of Maine riding. I happened to just change that and added a week or two, but in an old Creole home and courtyard in New Orleans. But it was a stretch goal, but I could envision it. So I think it's useful to do that, and I think it's a good point to maybe think about that in a language that somebody can really understand. And stretch goals, I've heard of stretch goals all along, and when I nudge somebody to do it, they can usually make a leap like that. Is that kind of what you had in mind, Eric?
Something like that, yes.
I mean, I'm interested in a better idea or a better framing. If you can come up with it.
No, I kind of like that. I believe in a very systematic approach when I coach.
Yeah.
I really like to, and you know this, from point A to point B to point C. So anything I can do to help prepare a client once success comes, and then hopefully, of course, we all as coaches want our clients to see extreme success, to try and help prepare them as much as we can before, during, and after, if you follow me. That's
definitely
really what I...
And that's, yeah, that what you just said is the bedrock of what we do in coaching, to create a system collaboratively, because winners and losers both have the same goals. Goals is not what distinguishes winners and losers. It's the system. And that's exactly... That's our specialty in coaching. So we are uniquely poised to do that with our clients in a collaborative way, with them as a point of reference, their story, and their needs and ideals and definition of success as a point of reference.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, great point, Eric. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah. What else? Who else? Other comments, questions? Well, I'll move into our topic, and jot down any questions you have. I'm eager to hear from you and look at with you each of the things that you'd like to talk a little bit further about or want to develop a little bit more, or any kind of brief vignettes that you may want to share. So hold on. We're going to go on mute, on lecture mode, rather. Okay, the particular challenges of extreme success are what I want to focus on, and from a coaching perspective, how, as Eric mentioned, to think about that, to prepare, to collaborate, and to plan for that. So let's first look at exceptional achievement and sometimes what accompanies it as overconfidence. Now, if you ask any player in a physician's basketball league whether he or she would compete with LeBron James, they would laugh. Yet many of those same physicians willingly compete with the billionaire investor Warren Buffett. I know these groups and I know these basketball teams very well. Cognitive biases and mental errors make them believe they can outperform successful full-time investment experts. Those who have achieved in exceptional ways create challenges for themselves just in the attainment of that success at times. Some highly successful people, from expert actors and athletes to practicing medical and legal experts, begin to think they can be good in other areas, such as investing, as if there's a carryover. Expertise in one area does not equate with expertise in another, though. Even Warren Buffett recognized this about himself. He said, you know, I don't think being able to allocate capital means I'm good at anything else. Overconfidence creates a misperception of ability when it's informed by spectacular success in one area. It sort of lights up the midbrain. University of Pennsylvania psychologists Philip Tetlock and Barbara Mellers studied over 25,000 forecasts from people whose task it was to anticipate how the future would unfold. Their studies, like a number of others, revealed exceptional overconfidence in the judgments of doctors, lawyers, engineers, even scientists in their decision-making processes. The stimulation of overconfidence is biologically habituating. Look at the recent revelations of politicians, actors, athletes who came to believe their success made them immune to boundary violations. From Macbeth, we learn that we are most vulnerable not when we're beginning, not even when we're destitute or needy, but after the biggest triumphs of our lives. For Macbeth, the moment the witches came was after the most massive successes he had experienced of winning two battles and enjoying immense popularity. Just look at Elvis, Marilyn, Janice, F. Scott, Kurt, Belushi, Philip Seymour. Some people need mentor coaches not to become successful, but to help them regulate their states of mind and manage emotions to sustain success. Complacency and overconfidence can become equal challenges. Navigating extreme success creates really unique challenges. Exceptional success transcends all usual and expectable categories, such as the athlete who plays exceptionally well or defies the limits of physical aging. It also occurs when accomplishments or the resultant fame or wealth transcend any possible anticipation, any preparation, or any model of engaging it. I heard Barry Manilow just very recently say, "I don't think anybody can really prepare for fame." And Keith Richards put it very succinctly, "Fame has killed a lot more really talented guys than drugs." So, let's talk about success anticlimax. After Bruce Jenner's last decathlon in Montreal, after spending almost four decades of his life doing only that, the next morning, he said, "What am I going to do now?" After long practiced and anticipated success, people often have to deal with success anticlimax. The sprint system is mediated by dopamine, the pleasure chemical. It can sustain the excitement of expectation, of anticipating a consequence. And we know from various performers, athletic, artistic, intellectual, that can last years or even decades. This shift to the neurochemical marathon system, then, after that excitement is over, like Bruce Jenner's, when that initial excitement is over, it's as if something's missing. It can even lead to feeling slightly depressed. I've heard a number of authors describe the letdown, even the depression after completing a book. I heard one author describe it as it's like a postpartum depression, and that was a guy. Robert Louis Stevenson said it very simply, "To travel hopefully is a better thing than to arrive." The athletes and executives I've worked with and others I have interviewed have learned to contend with the anticlimax of shifting from stimulating anticipation to the marathon system of sustaining maintenance and to dose anticipation in an effective way. The first time I was ever, and Eric, you've heard this story, so you can take a break and get a Coke right now. My first exposure to this whole notion of success anticlimax, one of the two major people in my life, my favorite sports coach, when I, as a freshman, made the traveling squad with 12 other people, I was totally intimidated by the other people on the team, and feeling I was lucky to be there. Just after we won our first tournament and boarded our bus, we were all feeling so great. It was a tournament waiting to go home and do the parade downtown. Coach stood at the front of the bus and looked at each of us. We were all still feeling great, even though he was looking pretty stern. We were eager to get home. He said, "So we won this tournament. This is not the biggest or the most prestigious tournament that we'll play. It's really kind of a podunk tournament." And then he said, "How many of you can really say you're proud to win this tournament?" Now, under any other circumstance, I would have raised my hand so quickly as I suspected my teammates won, but no one dared venture a single finger in the air. He concluded, "Feel good for now, but let's get home and really start working on being an excellent team." Coach knew how to handle success anticlimax, to ladder success. His life-changing coaching and the mentoring of me for 4 years resulted in many wins, a state championship, all-state. In reality, though, I was chief frog in an exquisitely minuscule pond, as I came to see later. But most importantly, resultant to careers of helping other people succeed, traces to him. For any physical or intellectual achievement, the emotional role and creative closure have to be addressed upon a successful completion. So this is really important, to look at how you can recover faster from success anticlimax, to look at what's next. And I'm going to come back to that and develop that further, because that's a crucial aspect of coaching. So does proven evidence change beliefs? Think about that for a minute. Does facts, information, proven evidence, how much does that change the way we think about things? Facts and beliefs are anatomical realities in our brains. You don't create a change by suddenly introducing a new idea and expect it to overwrite the one that's already there in the listener or reader's brain. Many of you have heard me say, if information was enough, we'd all exercise every day, eat mostly vegetables, be thin, have a lot of money saved up for the future, and a lot of librarians would be billionaires. Facts and logic are not powerful tools to alter opinions. Data is not a way to change minds. It's simply not how we decide. Established beliefs are really resistant to change, even when scientific evidence disproves those beliefs. People regard information as valid evidence when it fits with what they already know or believe. This is how arguments more staunchly solidify an original position. Presenting someone with information that contradicts an opinion most likely causes that person to generate new counterarguments to further strengthen their view, the boomerang effect. As a result, people grow more confident in their initial convictions and use information to polarize opinions. Think about how it works for abortion, gun control, climate change, just to name a few. We quickly accept evidence that confirms our preconceived notions, and we assess counter evidence with a critical, even disbelieving eye. Then we cherry pick information to fortify our beliefs without being even consciously aware of it. And you've heard me talk before about recent studies have shown that more intelligent and more psychologically flexible people are, the greater their ability to creatively rationalize and interpret information to fit their opinions. So the mind's desire for continuity and certainty, coupled with activating the brain's error detection mechanism with new and unexpected information, both contribute to the continuity of belief and action. So telling somebody what to do, giving them the facts, giving them instructions, is not the way to change their mind. The success trap in business is an almost ubiquitous phenomenon in which a company has to shift the way it operates in order to survive. The canal companies of the 1700s didn't become the railroad companies of the 1800s. They stuck to their box. And in the 1900s, there were no Union Pacific Airlines. They stuck to their box, good to gone. Kodak, who stuck to analog photography, did not evolve to digital. More recently, Andy Grove at Intel described the success trap as being a time in an organization's life when the leaders have to think differently. They have to move away from the organizational rigidity of developing and refining what's already successfully in place, and to think creatively of what can be. Grove put it this way, miss the moment and you start to decline. He noted the difficulty of Intel to move from memory chips to embrace the next technology of microprocessing in order to sustain the viability of the entire company. Successful performance for an individual or a company can sustain focus on what created the success rather than looking to the next success. Think about that in coaching. Think about that when your client successfully arrives at their goal. Your question is twofold. how do you sustain and enhance that? And how can you look at what's next that may not have occurred yet or you haven't thought about yet? The new success becomes the old success without a new model to step into. Attention to execution of the current success can miss the innovation needed to take the new steps forward. This is deliberate practice applied to a system of a team or a business. Here's an illustration. Brain scans of 63 seasoned business decision makers showed two things. Moving to new territory of exploratory strategies disengages from the pleasing routine of certainty. To leave the default mode to attend to new possibilities is uncomfortable and it takes more energy. So it's a natural resistance to do that, to want to stay with what has created that success and enjoy it because it's predictable. Yet at the same time, creative innovation stimulates brain circuitry of anticipation and reward. This is an even greater pleasure once the experience of recognizing the discomfort of leaving the certainty, of leaving the default mode and the predictability of it can be tolerated in order to embrace the new and the different, the what's next, the dopamine hit that can exceed and continue to sustain success. Now, let's look at some performance-related biases and their remedies. There are some specific biases that can be created or exaggerated by success that may be helpful for us to understand, because awareness of the tendency of these biases to psychologically influence decision can become important to recognize. It also becomes important because they can dilute optimum performance. One, self-deception. These deceptions have been distilled from a number of studies. These are in your outline. One is self-inflation. These are things we just listen for, and we hope to have developed a working alliance so we can get away with talking about it with a client if we hear it. Self-inflation, especially at times of significant success. For example, 94% of people place themselves at the top half of their profession. I mean, I know you guys are looking around to see what the other 93% underneath you are doing these days. 70% of both men and women feel they're better looking than average. 19% of people believe they're in the top 1% of income. 70% of drivers believe they're better than average. 75% of people consider themselves healthier than average. Simple self-deception. Another, derogation of others. This is the shadow story of self-inflation. It occurs when an image has been tarnished and there's a natural desire to lash out, a need to align with an in-group and degrade the outgoing, think of political parties, or to align with the powerful, think of Stockholm syndrome. Identification with the aggressor, if that's the only way that someone perceives they can participate in power. Another, moral superiority. Now, here's a natural study. Naturally, the referees are right when they call a foul on the visiting team. Often, their worst mistake is to call a foul on my favorite Houston Rocket. Now, if I ever moved to Dallas, it would be instantly my favorite Maverick, and the Rockets would be out of favor. Another is the illusion of control. When we feel a lack of control, a lack of effectiveness, it enhances our tendency to see meaningful patterns in otherwise random data. Why? Because this gives us a sense, a false sense, but a sense of effectiveness to be able to determine something. I'm mentioning and sort of highlighting and briefly illustrating these for you to cue your radar to to listen for these kinds of things in clients, you will hear some of them. Another, invincibility bias. Some common examples of invincibility bias. Adolescents tend to underestimate danger and to exaggerate anticipated performance, resulting in risky behavior. Heavy smokers underestimate their cancer risk despite obvious objective awareness. Skiers ignore warning signs and enter restricted areas to ski dangerous terrain. Someone sees a roulette wheel stop on red 6 times in a row, and whatever they know, they still believe the chances are higher than 50-50 it's going to stop on black the next time. 100% of those who believe the roulette wheel has a memory will abandon the 50-50 red-black possibility, although some are going to win their next bet and be right for the wrong reason. Optimism bias, the tendency to underestimate the possibility of bad things or things we don't want to look at or explore, to overestimate the possibility of good events. We underestimate the likelihood of a car accident, of having cancer. We overestimate our life expectancy and even future income. Newlyweds estimate the likelihood of divorce at darn close to zero, while statistically 40% will end in divorce. Hindsight bias. Knowing how things turned out can influence the way we both remember and even reframe past events to make an outcome seem inevitable. Think about Nassim Taleb's black swan effect. Subjectivity bias. We have an ability to spot thinking and systematic errors in others, yet we may struggle to look objectively to assess our own. Now, this is something that we want to help our clients develop in terms of their self-awareness, to become more subjectively aware, more empathic with themselves and their experience, and more objectively aware of themselves at the same time. And this is always what we're striving to do, because it's this self-reflection that is a major determinant of success and sustaining success. Present bias. We put great value in the present, so it may take a massive future reward to forego the impulse or pleasure of the present to invest in the future. The future, in a way, is both theory and an abstraction, kind of like as we talked moments ago about a goal. So it competes poorly with the immediate reward of the pleasure chemical of dopamine. Saving for the future, that's a good idea, but it's an abstraction. How can you convert that to a current action? One way, to make a good decision one time, by setting up an automatic transfer at the first of each month of a fixed amount of money from your checking account to your retirement account. One good decision. Transparency bias. We perceive fairness. And when we do, the brain releases dopamine. If we perceive unfairness, this triggers our reptilian brain that mediates a perception of threat and survival. Fairness is a keystone in both collaboration and leadership, and it can be overridden by the sense of unfairness to interfere with creativity, motivation, and teamwork. One of the major factors in the perception of fairness, which can determine a great deal of how people engage and collaborate, is transparency. When someone is transparent, it adds to this a great deal. A real simple example is if you ask a couple, how much of the housework do they estimate they do and their partner does? Every couple, essentially, will overestimate their own and underestimate what their partner does simply because they know and see their own, they don't see their partner, so they underestimate it. So transparency is often a factor that can make a difference. And when something takes little time or looks easy, or when the work itself is not visible, not transparent to the recipient, we can react significantly. For example, an attorney charging $500 an hour for work that's not transparent, or a plumber charging $200 for a visit when the actual repair only takes 2 minutes. So these are things to consider as we're listening to the stories of clients. A final one, projection bias. And then I'm going to talk about some remedies. People believe that others hold the same beliefs and values they do and will into the future. Let's think about that from a couple of perspectives. Fan psychology, the psychology of sports fans, employs some innate projection bias, as being a fan of a particular team or group by definition distorts thinking and creates biases. We identify with a player or performer or organization, and our thinking influences our behavior. This automatically frames how we view a call by a referee and how we immediately lapse into all or nothing good or bad thinking. Another example is seeing how ethnocentric our own views in the United States are when traveling to different parts of the world. A projection of our belief or value onto another instantly creates a connection, though. Both projection bias as well as fan psychology are in part about belonging, about connection, of identifying with a group that shares beliefs and values. And this is powerful because this is mediated by oxytocin, the neurochemical system of bonding and connection. Now, let's look at some bias remedies. A bias means that we not only ignore certain facts, but we also have to specifically ignore disconfirming data. Don't tell me the facts to change my mind. Facts contrary to beliefs and self-images are rapidly dismissed, simply not engaged, or we just fail to see it, inattention blindness. A cue for a bias can simply be an anchor for booting up a particular mindset. And think about how that can apply. It can be race, gender, weight, any number of other things that automatically and largely unconsciously get our own attribution. Think about how some of our biases are ones that we would consciously abhor, yet they still exist, and are ones that we have to become aware of. Groupthink can simply be shared blind spots. We ignore contrary evidence and share a self-deception, and we work diligently to preserve our opinions, even though we may not consciously know exactly what they are. That sounds almost contradictory. The challenge, then, is to recognize, own, and assess certain aspects of our own stories. Notice this is the first three steps of the roadmap system. The primary reasons, it's a challenge. New information can cause unpleasant feelings. New information may demand a change in beliefs or just perturbate your existing belief. It's story busting. We tend to seek information that confirm our beliefs rather than disprove them. And also, new information may require us to take undesired actions. So, to leave the security of our known stories, in any kind of story busting or any kind of breaking the script, the certainty and the predictability of how it will turn out, if it's different, feels like we're losing control. We are motivated to avoid new information, especially if we expect bad news. Seeking a consultation with a doctor about certain symptoms confronts denial and the pain of undergoing testing. It's also more difficult when the information is either hard to understand or interpret. So we first have to realize what we don't know. This is difficult because how do you come to know what you don't know? Candid, open feedback from trusted others becomes one way. You may become the only person as the mentor coach of your client who can get away with saying what you need to say, but you'll have to do it in a collaborative way, in a way that is collegial, and knowing, both of you, that you have totally the best interest of the client at heart. Candid, open feedback from trusted others is so crucial. In executive coaching, some of you have used, I've used at times, a 360 assessment to have someone self-assess and then get assessments on the same questions from a group of people who know that person well. This challenges the comfort zone but provides objective and sometimes really valuable information. Now, I want to look at the hubris syndrome for just a minute. While confidence is a state of mind that generates remarkable productivity, overconfidence can become a slayer of success. While our minds constantly learn from challenges, internally and externally, the creative and empathic process can be derailed by the complacency of power. It's been shown that the more that we know and the better we become, the more likely we are to overestimate our own ability as well as underestimate the events beyond our control. In one study, CEOs became more confident as they gained merger and acquisition experience, resulted in their overvaluation of subsequent deals. In research from the University of Vienna, investors who obtained significant experience with their market became overconfident and made risky asset investments. Overconfidence and the brain's potentiation of stimulation, in other words, to get accustomed to that stimulation, enhances with sustained success and power. Our brains can habituate to that excitement and that activation. Blind certainty can then replace active self-reflection. Overconfidence increases with these things: familiarity, repetition, information, sustained success. One of the best predictors of overconfidence is power, which enhances with time and experience and can result in the cessation of questioning alternate possibilities. So, one thing I want to consider just briefly is to look at talent and the role of talent, maybe even a bit of the disadvantage of talent. A growth mindset recognizes talents that can be enhanced through dedication and deliberate practice. A fixed mindset sees talents as either present or not present, not to be developed. Edwin Moses, winner of 107 consecutive races and 4 world records, he was a beautiful runner to watch. He said, "I ran against a lot of individuals who are probably a lot more physically talented than me." We now know from a number of perspectives that talent is not a genetic gift, but a development process. It can be enhanced when it's recognized, focused on, and nurtured by parents, teachers, coaches, and mentors. To recognize an advanced talent, like, let's say, in sports, in socially prominent areas, is easy. Baseball, basketball in the United States is visible. People can see it. Soccer in England, ice hockey in Canada. Sports make it easy because they're so identifiable, so visual, and so measurable. Talent in other areas may not be as easily recognized, perhaps not easy at all because it's not transparent. Talent in art, verbal ability, physical and mental skills become challenges to identify and facilitate. Now, while there are different innate physical and mental capacities, just as individual personality and learning styles, the developmental process must be systematically nurtured by discipline and practice and mentoring in whatever development of skill there is. The optimum model evolved from various studies about the development of expertise and talent contains 3 aspects. early diversification, not getting locked in too early, sampling of a number of activities, very related, exposure for both informed choices and long-term development. Deliberate play, for example, of experiencing sport through fun and playful games builds a solid foundation of intrinsic motivation. Deliberate play enhances a range of cognitive and motor experience to develop both expertise and self-management in development of skills. Now, experts say that perhaps by age 13, that should be the earliest that specialization occurs. And then only by late adolescence have children developed the physical, social, cognitive, emotional skills needed to specialize in one sport or endeavor. Just as a kind of a sidebar example, I've worked with two child prodigy musicians who became internationally famous, but they devoted their entire lives from age four, one of them, and age five, another, to their skill. They were both pianists. And by the time I saw them, they were so incredibly unhappy. They had no idea how to interact with people because they'd been at the piano for a decade, one, and decade and a half, another. So this is where balance comes in. Now, a composite of study, a number of studies, really, of elite performers across a number of fields have found these common traits that characterize their development and their experience. Managing anxiety and pressure situation. We've talked about each of these, and you'll see in your outline some tools for each of these. Confidence, mental toughness and resilience, the ability to focus and not be distracted by various kinds of attention-getting distractions, a hard work ethic, the practice of setting and achieving goals, being coachable and having a mentor coach, and optimism. Now, a quick question. Is there a disadvantage of talent? Now, the talent myth assumes a fixed mindset. Why spend talent and energy trying to improve if success only comes to people with the right talent or genes? That skill and intelligence can be improved is a growth mindset. Talent can be a particular disadvantage in this case if someone with a natural talent may not at the beginning of their skill development subject themselves to the same hard work, rigors, and dedication as with someone without those abilities. I never had that problem, but I saw in a couple of instances people who were exceptionally talented, they didn't have to work so hard at it, so they didn't develop a work ethic, and later they paid a price for that. Natural talent can suffice for a period of time, but if it replaces the discipline and dedication to practice that needs to be developed, it can be a disadvantage. Those with less skills early on have to work harder to develop them and may establish a systematic way to grow and improve in the process. Even Einstein said, "It's not that I'm so smart, it's just that I stay with problems longer." Without relying totally on a natural capacity, intellectually, athletic, any skill, they persevere through adversity to hone a foundation of repeatable strategies and skill development. I'm saying this to think about how you can help your clients develop this kind of resilience. A shadow story of talent is that it can mask poor teaching or coaching for a significant period of time, or even until it's time to play a bigger game in some challenging way, intellectually or physically. Now, I want to talk a little bit about sustainable success and then move into a discussion. After their first unprecedentedly successful whirlwind tour of the United States, the first thing the Beatles did when they got back to England was go to the studio and make their next album. And they made a new album regularly every 6 months. They didn't bask in their victory or let it derail their plans. They consolidated the success to integrate it with ongoing focus and their plan to be in the studio and crank out a new album every 6 months. They pressed their advantage but didn't let success derail their plans or hijack their focus. Let me give you an illustration of this from a coaching perspective. A client I'll call Evelyn consulted me because she was having burnout in her career. She had enjoyed remarkable and rapid success as an actress, quickly moved through local theater production, national commercials, and a role in a nationally syndicated series. Her energy brightened a room. It induced optimism in others. People were impressed with her imagination, her creative presence. Being very highly intuitive and sensitive allowed her attunement and connection to others, as well as to the development of the character she played in film. With this sensitivity came the resonance with stressful emotions from those around her, resulting in feeling emotionally drained by other people, especially by crowds. She described her sensitivity to family and friends, especially by fans who would approach her. She would go out just to go to a restaurant, and people would approach her. They'd want her autograph or a selfie or just to say hi, just to be seen by her. And she wanted to please them. She enjoyed the popularity, but she felt totally depleted at the end of this, and it took her not just an hour or two to recover, but it would take her at times a couple of days to recover. And she questioned whether the burnout meant that she was not suited for what she was doing, even though she enjoyed the recognition, the stardom a great deal, and was passionate, though, about developing her craft. So as we looked at her state of mind after these experiences, she described how she had to go home because she was depleted, how for a long time she would feel depleted. Even a nap wouldn't restore her energy. Her high degree of creativity and imagination was natural for her specific work, but she hadn't developed the buffers and the boundaries to regulate her state of mind in her public and in her private time, resulting in significant depletion. And her read was burnout. So she needed to develop an internal point of reference, even more than most people, and to develop her intuitive, empathic style to be for herself as well as others, and to develop her own story, her own self-regulation. So she developed an awareness of how the character, for example, that she inhabited for a screen role was itself a state of mind, and how to effectively enter and exit that state of mind each day so she could preserve her own private space, not intermingle the two. She learned how to dose time and titrate her exposure to others to reduce the excessive stimulation of crowds, even of individual other people, especially ones that were needy or negative or just wanting to have her recognize them. She learned that no did not need to be framed as guilt, but as self-care. By protecting herself in this way and being attuned to the necessary boundaries, she maintained her valued sensitivity and empathic resonance with herself as well as others without absorbing the impact of the feeling of others. This actually enhanced her immersion in the characters that she played because she knew how to exit that character at the end of the day, and it blocked any negativity that she had. This capacity for staying fully centered and for full emotional engagement generated significant further success and awards for her. After much research, she could become the character she played, but she also, at the end of the day, became more of who she really was, and those boundaries became clear. She was grounded, centered, learned how to develop that, how to develop performance cues to enter the state and to enter her own state for herself at the end of the day. Now, I've included in the outline some distinctions. I'm not going to go through each of them, but I want to highlight just maybe a half dozen of these about the difference between experts and amateurs. Look at these in your outline when you have time and interest, because I'm defining here an expert and an amateur really as states of mind. The expert is an ideal, a contrast to the amateur. Evolution from amateur to expert is a significant life-changing passage when it occurs. Here are some distinctions that can apply to that process of transformation. I'm only going to highlight five or six. So just listen to these and see what you think as you hear them. You can read all the others that I don't say later. Experts continue concentrated, deliberate practice in focused areas to develop informed feedback. Amateurs get to a level of good enough and stay there. Experts seek practice and goals that exceed current levels of performance. Amateurs seek to sustain a comfort level and don't challenge it. The expert loves and pursues the game, whatever the game is, with total dedication and passion. The amateur perceives it as a sideline, part-time, like a weekend warrior. The expert knows that fairness is a childhood wish, that in adulthood, there is not even an ultimate arbiter of fairness. There is always adversity, unlevel fields, bad hops, rotten calls, injustice, unfairness. The amateur seeks fairness and is set back with what does not seem fair. The expert does whatever it takes, even what never could have been imagined. The amateur needs predictability, consistency, assuredness of results. The expert dedicates to mastery. The amateur dedicates to proving himself or herself, needing to consistently demonstrate superiority and competence. The expert shows up every day, no matter what, is committed for the long haul. The expert understands delayed gratification, is the ant, not the grasshopper, the tortoise, not the hare. The amateur shows up as long as something else doesn't get in the way, and looks for shortcuts or quick results and immediate gratification. Experts know they can do their best with what they do uniquely well. The amateur tries to do a bunch of things, to be everything to many people. The expert knows that the self and every storyline in life are created moment by moment, that the ultimate abandonment is of oneself. The amateur believes that there's a whole lot predetermined, some fate, some circumstance, some luck. Consistent attention must be given to be appreciated and accepted by others. The expert believes that we write, live, and create in order to know. The amateur believes that we must know in order to write, live, and create. And one final one I want to highlight. The expert knows that courage is to proceed despite fear. The amateur believes that courage is the absence of fear. Now, as a summary sentence or two, the application of these principles that we've gone through in these four seminars of stress mastery and peak performance can apply to all areas of business, education, arts, health, human relationships, as well as sports, as you've heard analogies or examples from each of these. As we become more self-reflective and better learners, we more effectively write our own stories and catalyze those stories in our clients, whether they're life, career, wellness, relationship, money, performance, or any other stories. All are our contributions to ourselves and to our clients. So I want to thank you. I'll go off lecture mode in 1 second. Thanks so much for your time and interest, as well as all the feedback and kind words. I'll be eager to hear how you use and apply these ideas, and if they're helpful to you in your coaching practice to use with clients. And I want to add a footnote here. I've received some requests from some of you about the NeuroMentor Institute of Peak Performance, the training to become a specialty certified peak performance coach. I didn't want to discuss that. I don't want to do anything that interferes with our focus here on the CTA seminar series. I'll send something after this is all over to you about that so that you'll get information on that. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. I'm eager to hear from you. Thoughts, questions, clarifications, anything that you'd like to talk about, and you know, let's plan to hang out for a discussion after the top of the hour if you're interested and if you have some thoughts and questions and things you'd like to talk about. So I'd love to hear from you about what you found helpful, if there are some questions you still have of clarification or things you'd like to hear even more about. What you got?
Hi, it's Marianne.
Welcome. Hey, how are you?
Good. Okay, so I had a question. I had a client that I was working with that was having trouble dealing with a 13-year-old. Whenever she would ask her
I'm sorry, when you say trouble with what?
Dealing with a 13-year-old, a teenager.
Okay.
So she tends to get tense when she asks her something, but when her son would ask her something, she's fine. It's just something that's between her and her daughter. So we discussed it, and our takeaway was to plan to write down 5 positive things about her daughter and review them nightly. So is that like a rewiring? Is there more that's needed to get that to rewire her feelings that she shouldn't get that tenseness?
Is it working?
Well, we just did it, so I didn't speak to her again yet.
Okay. Well, that's no matter how fancy the theory or how sophisticated all the logic and intellect, the bottom line is always, does it work? Because that's what we want to do with our clients, is to help. And if it doesn't work, we do something else. If it works, do more of it. Now, here's a byproduct that I keep hearing about with all the coaches I train, that as they learn ways to engage people and engage conversations, instead of giving them facts, information, telling them what to do, if they engage with a question, because this is one of the hardest things for people who really, really know what to do. That includes parents. That includes professional coaches, sports coaches. If you know what to do, it's the hardest thing in the world to not tell somebody what they need to do, because you know exactly what they need to do. Guaranteed not to work. The hardest thing for parents of adolescents as well as professional coaches to do with their players is, instead of telling somebody what to do, guaranteed not to work, is to ask a question. Because when you ask a question, there's no pushback. There's nothing that somebody is going to oppose, because when you ask a question, somebody needs to engage with you to answer that, so you've created instantly a framework of collaboration. That's what characterizes the unique contribution that we have as professional coaches that makes us unique to every other professional in every other specialty area. We engage in one of collaboration. Every other professional is a consultant. They'll tell you what to do, and you'll pay good money for them to tell you what to do. Now, does it work? Not exactly. Some of you have heard me give this example. Let's say you go to let's say the expert is a physician. And you're motivated by pain, being scared about something. You go to the physician gives you expert advice in the form, let's say, of a prescription. How well is that followed? Less than 1 in 2 people actually fill that prescription. Of those who fill it, less than 1 in 2 actually take it as directed. So even when somebody's motivated and pain, pays good money for an expert and gets a very specific recommendation, less than 25% of them actually follow it. And those of you who are parents to adolescents, you know that question. I bet you'd pay good money for that kind of percentage of response and listening, less than 25%. Ask a question. Collaborate. Use a collaborative model. You will be amazed at the shift when you ask a question and treat your adolescent, as well as your client, as another viable collaborator and colleague. Now, does that answer your question maybe in a
yes.
different way than you? Okay.
Interesting,
super.
Yeah. Actually, my asking her a question led to that plan, because I asked her, what are positive things that you could think about your daughter? And she had a hard time coming up with them. So I helped her develop them, and then I figured that if she reviews them, then that will rewire her.
May I coach you for a moment about a subtle process to be aware of?
Yes.
Okay.
Please.
When a client has trouble coming up with something, our temptation is to help them along and to come up with something, maybe to make suggestions. What I think you need to listen for is the process here. What is the process is always a question that we need to have in mind in coaching, because we usually focus on the content, because the content is specific. It brings closure. Somebody tells you what they want to focus on for this session, and boom, you're into the content, often forgetting to ask, where would you like us to get to, because you're locked into the... That creates a closure in your mind and in the client's mind, just like offering a suggestion does, because that brings closure, and there's no more dissonance. There's no more cognitive dissonance on the client's part or on your part. So keeping it open, I think, will be very important to not bring that closure. And if the client subtly gets you to participate with them, what's the process here? Is the process that the client is showing you what it's like to be them, that they have a codependent attachment pattern where they don't quite know what to do, and they get somebody else subtly but surely to take over and suggest for them? So they're getting someone else to function for them in a way that they need to function for themselves, which is the definition of codependency. So be sure you're not doing that as a coach, because you will have clients who have this attachment pattern and have developed it in such a seamless and artful way that they get all kind of people to give them advice and tell them what to do. Never mind that it either doesn't work or doesn't listen, but they have all kind of people directing them, and that's their attachment pattern. So here's where the process shows you exactly what it's like to be the client, if this is the case, and what you'll have to address that is not specific, tangible, and concrete as a part of the content, but it's the process that becomes manifest. Does that make sense to you, first of all?
Yes, very much so. Very much so.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
This is exactly why, for example, as we've touched on before, as coaches, we'll never need to go back into the history of something, of the why, or understanding the depth or the dynamics, because every algorithm in someone's brain will manifest in the relationship with you in a here and now way, either in the process or the content or both. So everything that you'll need to address in working with your client is going to be manifest together here and now in one way or another. So it's always in the present, and the important things will show themselves vividly with you and suggest things that need to be addressed, as you'll hear the biases, the scripts that someone has and wants others to fit into those scripts. So just be aware both of the content and the process, because this is where we earn our money, really, where the issues manifest in the process, and they're not so logical or conscious or intellectual, but yet they're very real. And just by addressing these can account then for significant success in that client's life.
Amazing. Thank you.
Thank you. Great questions. Other thoughts, questions, things that might be helpful to talk about?
This is Christine. I had a question about how long you anticipate having the sessions available for.
I don't know about forever, but I know they'll be available for the rest of the year, probably a calendar year. So they're
okay.
going to be available.
Okay. Because I wanted to go back and review them. So okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah. See, by the time you reviewed them, maybe the second or so time, I'll have changed my mind. So tune in for the new version. Okay.
Yeah.
No, it should be available for some time. And remember the outline, probably already downloaded the outline and the resource guide to work along with it. Yeah. Thoughts, questions?
David. Oh, hi, David. This is Lana.
Hey, welcome. How are you?
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I've been very close to this for this whole seminar, but I just wanted to literally say thank you. I found this portion of identifying emotional triggers and reframing and working through how I would respond. I've coached myself on this for probably the last month. I think we started within the first session, and
yeah.
I like to have the personal experience before I can share this or with clients. But for me, this has been life-changing, and I'm not joking when I say that. I mean, because I had some triggers with myself that once I identified them, I reframed them, I identified how I would normally respond, and then I came up with sort of three words that were very empowering, and then I would be able to calm myself, have confidence, and have courage, and I would just not go down my normal spiral and analytical and get stuck and feel sick, and it has literally changed my life. So I absolutely appreciate this and just wanted to say thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for sharing that, and I think that's exactly what can be most helpful for each of us is to really develop and become aware fully of our own story and to make the kinds of tweaks and adjustments and revisions that we want to make that the fullest and the most successful story possible. We're going to be in the best position then to help our clients develop their stories and to keep the point of reference for the client and to develop that optimally with them. And, you know, we just have to be a step or two ahead of them, but we're continuing to work on our own stories and have a growth mindset of looking at what's next and what's possible. And that's exactly the thing that distinguishes remarkable, sustained success from peaking and stopping, is with remarkable success, the idea is how to sustain and expand that and always ask what's next. And that's going to look different at the top of the mountain than the system it took to get up to the top of the mountain. But the process is the same. What's next and what can I do that's better and more complete? So that's an important aspect that is a kind of a summary overview of what we've been talking about for 4 weeks. So thanks very much, Lana. That's great. I'm happy for you.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, that experience is why I do what I do that you just heard described. That's why probably each of you do what you're doing is it really does help people, and that's exciting stuff.
It really is.
Other thoughts or questions or things that might be helpful to talk about?
Hi, this is Muge.
I'm sorry, this is who?
Muge.
Welcome, hey.
Hi. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on if we're dealing with a client who has to perform but is in that overconfidence kind of mode where they're not any more learners or growth oriented, and how we can kind of keep their confidence but not to the point where they're actually working against their performance ultimately.
how do you assess overconfidence? And is it something you're seeing the clients not seeing? But how do you assess that?
Well, I think I wrote to you in one of my emails. I work with an investment company, and I deal with individuals who are dealing with, like, lots of money, asset management, basically. And depending on how the market is going, often they perform very, very well in the very beginning. And that kind of creates a sort of, you know, confidence in them. But the problem with that is that not that they don't know what they're doing, but often they need some coaching from their managers, or they need to kind of work within a team. And as soon as they kind of reach that point of, oh, no, I know what I'm doing, they fall out of the team. They become more individualistic. So the managers that I talk to have problems with those individuals. And then I'm supposed to coach them to kind of, you know, bring them back within the team. I guess that is how I know they become more confident than they should.
Okay. What have you come to see about how they move into that realm of overconfidence, that their judgments are then compromised with that kind of hubris syndrome or that kind of overconfidence that may not be warranted, except it's definitely a feeling and a state of mind?
If I understand you correctly, the thing I notice is that they're just not, you know, if you're working within a team, I guess it's no different than any person's soccer team. If you have one individual, you know, who's becomes a star for one season, and then suddenly thinks that, okay, now I can tackle the opposite team all by myself, without taking into consideration his teammates or his, you know, coaches, then they become very difficult to deal with within that team or organization. And
okay, let me interrupt you and be specific, because I want to give you the best answer possible, or the thinking about when you are called in for that individual. Does that individual recognize that they're a little bit beyond the pale of where they need to be, or is that because management has identified them as a problem that they don't yet recognize? Is it one of those two?
Yes, it's management that recognizes that, not them.
Okay, so you're sitting across from someone who management has identified, who has gone beyond the point of being effective and successful, to already have evidence of a compromise because of past success or whatever. But there's concrete or tangible evidence that they're not sticking with the formula that got them there. Is that correct?
Yes, more or less so, exactly.
Okay. So with this person then, you and management and the person may need to come together by simply asking the person what their assessment is of their performance currently, and if there are any things that are challenging or need to be addressed. Now, if the person does not recognize that or is in total denial, it's not your job to confront that, because that's going to scuttle whatever kind of working alliance you have with that person. That may be a time then, or even before then, if you know, and if management knows that person's not working well or not insightful and is in denial, that may be a time to do a 360, where the person does a self-assessment, other people immediately on the team do an assessment, so that the person sees that their assessment of themselves is in contradistinction to other people, so you then have the potential for an alliance to help the person look at and understand that, because you're aligning with someone who's had a setback and had negative feedback. You're not the enemy. You're the mentor coach who can help someone understand and create a success scenario out of demonstrated challenges and issues that are, that have been identified. So the question here is kind of like asking a question instead of giving information and telling somebody what to do. The question here is, how can you create an alliance with that person to understand and revise their story going forward? Asking a question, aligning with their experience and their situation may be a challenge, but it may be the best possibility that you have of having a true client instead of somebody who's been assigned to you who's going to just replicate the denial and say, well, again, yeah, I had a bad quarter, but look at all my success. Does that approach make sense to you?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Okay. Does it sound workable in the situation you described? I know we didn't have time to go into it in a bunch of detail.
I mean, I would have to try it. I think I don't. I think it definitely might be a step closer, because you don't want to. As a coach, I don't want to tell them. But often they are in denial, and
yeah,
they are
it wouldn't
an issue
work.
For management.
I mean, you would create an alienation if you did that.
Yes, exactly.
You know, just like the parent of the adolescent, you tell them what to do, and man, you know, you have one enemy in the world. I mean, because it won't work. So, the idea is, how can we create a framework of collaboration and moving forward? So here's the final thing I want to say, and I know we're past when I said, draw a circle in the middle of a page, just one big circle. Inside that circle, draw a stick figure. Now, your challenge is to get inside the circle, because that stick figure is your client. Now, that may be a team, an organization, but let's say it's a client. Your challenge is to get inside the circle, because outside the circle, nobody's going to listen to you. That client is not going to listen to you. How do you get inside the circle? You resonate with their experience. You begin with an empathic resonance. You begin with a question. You create a collaborative framework, because once you're inside the circle, a way to get in and a way to stay there is one of collaboration, of moving forward together with the same objective. That's what we do uniquely in coaching. That's why we want to know what the challenge of that person is, to know better how to get inside that circle. Now, in a different context, we're not going to go there this time, but in that stick figure, that is also, if you're selling products or services or a program, that stick figure is your potential customer or client. You need to know their challenges. You need to know how to resonate with what they need before you begin to offer anything. So for right now, though, it's the client, and what they need is a collaborative understanding to proceed together. That's the bedrock of what we do in coaching. Hey, well, I know we're out of time, even a little bit over. Thanks so much for all of your responses, your kind words. Thanks very, very much for your participation. I hope you've enjoyed it even close to as much as I have, and you've made it really exciting and meaningful to engage with you and to look at some things in a different way, and I appreciate that. I'll be interested in how this works for you, and don't hesitate to let me know if I can be of help in any way. Thanks so much. See you guys. Bye now.
Bye.
Bye.